Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Good to have you with us. We're at 6:10 and a lot going on the front with Ukraine, Russia, and the United States. The president speaking yesterday afternoon. President Biden at the White House spoke for about 10 minutes, then took some questions. And we've got some important highlights from yesterday's briefing by the president and the follow-up questions from the media. We're going to get into it this morning with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. We'll get his read from a military standpoint. Then we'll be talking with KT McFarland, and we will get her read from a foreign policy perspective. John Gizzi will be speaking with us also this morning. He is, of course, the White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. And we're going to check in with John. He'll have the political ramifications as well as some of the other perspectives from Capitol Hill this week. 30th Democrat has announced that they will not be seeking re-election. We'll tell you who that is this morning. We've got Jim Trusty to join us as well, and when we get with Jim this morning, we're going to talk about the civil suit that was filed against Alec Baldwin. Of course, you remember the shooting on the set of the film Rust, which resulted in the death of a cinematographer. Her family has filed a wrongful death suit against Alec Baldwin. And we're going to get into that with Jim Trusty this morning. You might have heard the real firestorm this week, and that was on the Durham investigation, John Durham probe. There was a filing he made last weekend and raised a lot of eyebrows about the involvement of Hillary Clinton's campaign in the run-up to the election. And then after the election, some apparent surveillance on the Trump campaign and the Trump White House. That's what is alleged in some of the reports that have come out this week. And we're going to drill into that with Jim Trusty this morning, and we'll get a real perspective from Jim on that. But we do want to check traffic. Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
In Maryland, on the VW Parkway, Riverdale, there is a vehicle fire right at 410. On the Maryland side of the Beltway, all lanes are clear on the inner loop and on the outer loop. On the Virginia side of the Beltway, on the inner loop, you're going to find it slow in McLean between 495 express lanes and the GW Parkway. On 66 in Fairfax County, no reports of any crashes or construction eastbound or westbound. And 95 in Virginia, both northbound and southbound between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, you'll find all lanes clear. Go ahead and set your cruise control. Nothing will slow you down. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy start to the weekend. We will see some gusty winds as a cold front shifts through midday. Highs today into the upper 40s. The cold front will shift through anywhere between 11 o'clock this morning west of town, 1 to 2 o'clock to the south and east. Behind that front, we'll have some very gusty winds through the afternoon. A wind advisory is in effect through 7 o'clock. Could see gusts upwards of 50 miles per hour. Now, winds will diminish tonight. Clear skies. It will be cold. Lows in the teens to 20s across the region. For your Sunday, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 40s. Warm up on President's Day Monday. High temperatures near 60 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Ligg at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Currently in Washington, 25 degrees, 6:15, the Saturday Morning Update. President Biden yesterday at the White House, speaking to reporters and speaking to the nation, and he gave an update opening his speech with the status of things as they stood Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock with Russia and Ukraine.
Throughout these tense moments, the Ukrainian forces have shown great judgment and, I might add, restraint. They refused to allow the Russians to bait them into war. But the fact remains, Russian troops currently have Ukraine surrounded from Belarus along the Russian border and with Ukraine to the Black Sea in the south and all of its border. You know, look, we have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people. We're calling out Russia's plans loudly and repeatedly, not because we want a conflict, but because we're doing everything in our power to remove any reason that Russia may give to justify invading Ukraine and prevent them from moving. Make no mistake, if Russia pursues its plans, it will be responsible for a catastrophic and needless war of choice. The United States and our allies are prepared to defend every inch of NATO territory from any threat to our collective security as well. We also will not send troops in to fight in Ukraine, but we will continue to support the Ukrainian people.
And also, the president did have a conversation with NATO leaders.
Over the last few days, we've seen reports of a major uptick in violations of the ceasefire by Russian-backed fighters attempting to provoke Ukraine and the Donbas. For example, a shelling of a Ukrainian kindergarten yesterday, which Russia has falsely asserted was carried out by Ukraine. And we also continue to see more and more disinformation being pushed out by to the Russian public, including Russian-backed separatists, claiming that Ukraine is planning to launch a massive offensive attack in the Donbas. Well, look, there is simply no evidence of these assertions, and it defies basic logic to believe the Ukrainians would choose this moment with well over 150,000 troops arrayed on its borders to escalate a year-long conflict. Russia's state media also continues to make phony allegations of a genocide taking place in the Donbas and push fabricated claims warning about Ukraine's attack on Russia without any evidence. That's just what I'm sure Ukraine's thinking of doing, attacking Russia. All of these are consistent with the playbook the Russians have used before to set up a false justification to act against Ukraine. This is also in line with the pretext scenarios that the United States and our allies and partners have been warning about for weeks.
So that's comments from the president yesterday, and he summed up, it was only about a 7 or 8 minute speech that he gave, and here's how he summed it up with the bottom line.
But the bottom line is this. The United States and our allies and partners will support the Ukrainian people. We will hold Russia accountable for its actions. The West is united and resolved. We're ready to impose severe sanctions on Russia if it further invades Ukraine. But I say again, Russia can still choose diplomacy. It is not too late to de-escalate and return to the negotiating table. Last night, Russia agreed that Secretary of State Blinken and Foreign Minister Lavrov should meet on February 24th in Europe. But if Russia takes military action before that date, we'll be clear that they have slammed the door shut on diplomacy. They will have chosen war, and they will pay a steep price for doing so, not only from the sanctions that we and our allies will impose on Russia, but the moral outrage the rest of the world will visit upon them. You know, there are many issues that divide our nation and our world, but standing up to Russian aggression is not one of them. The American people are united. Europe is united. The transatlantic community is united. Our political parties in this country are united. The entire free world is united. Russia has a choice between war and all the suffering it will bring, or diplomacy that will make a future safer for everyone.
And that pretty much wrapped up the president's comments. And when the president takes questions, sometimes you get into a little more detail. You get into the things that maybe his handlers didn't want to have him talking about. One of the questions concerned his comment about he being convinced that Vladimir Putin would attack. And here was the first of the questions about whether he was convinced.
And do you have any indication about whether President Putin has made a decision on whether to invade? Do you feel confident that he hasn't made that decision already?
As of this moment, I'm convinced he's made the decision. We have reason to believe that.
You are convinced that President Putin is going to invade Ukraine. Is that what you just said a few moments
ago?
Yes,
I did. Yes.
What reason do you have to believe he's considering that option at all?
We have a significant intelligence capability.
All right, so he made that comment about being convinced, and then he was asked again whether he was convinced.
To be clear, you are convinced that President Putin is going to invade Ukraine. Is that what you just said a few moments
ago?
Yes,
I did. Yes.
So is diplomacy off the table then?
No. Until he does, diplomacy is always a possibility.
What reason do you have to believe he's considering that option at all?
We have a significant intelligence capability. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
So that's how it kind of ended rather rapidly, and that was the big question about whether he was convinced. There was one other question that he took, and this I want to play this because you're going to be hearing about this today, that the reports are that Russia has scheduled what they're calling nuclear drills today. And for a little bit of explanation, we thought we'd let the president give it to you.
President Putin is going to oversee some nuclear drills this weekend. How do you see that happening? What's your reaction to that, sir? Thank you.
Well, I don't think he is remotely contemplating nuclear, using nuclear weapons. But I do think it's, I think he is focused on trying to convince the world that he has the ability to change the dynamics in Europe in a way that he cannot. But I don't, how much of it is a cover for just saying we're just doing exercises and there's more than that, I just can't. It's hard to read his mind.
So that was the president, and again, that was yesterday afternoon around 4 o'clock, in the 4 o'clock hour. And I wanted to play it for you in your entirety, because if you're watching the headlines on cable news, you'll get about 10 seconds, and it's out of context, and much better to get the full details from the president there. And there is one clip I want to play from an earlier press briefing in the day. This was with, of course, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary. She was asked a couple of questions about strategy from Jackie Heinrich at Fox News. And here's how that went down between Jen Psaki and Jackie Heinrich of Fox News.
The sanctions, we've learned, don't include SWIFT. They don't target energy, so the impacts to other countries are mitigated. You guys have attributed the cyber attack to Russia, and you're warning that the prospect of war is, or peace rather, is pretty dim. So at what point do you break away from the strategy, say it's not working, and do something else, impose some of these sanctions now?
Well, I think as we've talked about a little bit in here, our collective view from our national security team is that sanctions are meant to be a deterrent. They are not. If you put all of the sanctions in place now, what is stopping them from invading?
Are they working?
Well, again, Jackie, I think that's our assessment from the national security team. That we will continue to implement that strategy.
To die before implementing them in that case.
I think, Jackie, that's in no way a fair statement or accusation, I guess, if that's what that is. What we have done and what the president has done is unite countries around the world on a strong package that will be crippling to the Russian economy. And we have done that in a way where we have stood up for the territorial integrity of Ukraine and stood with our NATO partners.
All right, so that's the very latest from pretty much what's going on at the White House with Russia and Ukraine. So there are some other things we're going to be talking about this morning here on the Saturday Morning Update. One of the major developments on the legal front yesterday in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, finally the sentencing of the Brooklyn Center police officer Kim Potter. Now, you may remember that the former officer fatally shot Dante Wright while yelling taser during a traffic stop. And, of course, that was a traffic stop turned attempted arrest, and it became a shooting. She pulled her revolver instead of her taser. Well, she was sentenced yesterday to 2 years in prison. It was a first-degree manslaughter charge. It carried a maximum sentence of 15 years in prison and possibly up to a $30,000 fine. The Hennepin County District Court Judge Regina Chu opted to give Potter a much lighter sentence than recommended by the state sentencing guidelines. Now, Potter has served 58 days in jail already. She got a 2-year sentence. She's expected to serve 16 months in prison and add about a third of her sentence on supervised release. It's 6:27. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
And in some of the headlines at this hour, separatist leaders in eastern Ukraine have ordered a full military mobilization amid those growing fears that Russia is planning to invade Ukraine. The announcement came this morning amid a spike in violence along the line of contact between Ukrainian forces and the pro-Russia rebels in recent days. Yesterday, separatist authorities in eastern Ukraine announced a mass evacuation of women, children, and older adults to neighboring Russia. The moves have fueled Western fears that Moscow could use the latest violence in eastern Ukraine as a pretext for an invasion. Police in Canada say they have made more than 100 arrests and progress in clearing out truckers who have made the paralyzation of Ottawa the headlines now for 3 weeks. That protest against the country's COVID-19 restrictions. Hundreds of police moving into the capital downtown Friday morning and began taking protesters into custody and towing away some of the large semi-tractor trailers blocking the streets in Ottawa. Many of the truckers left on their own. And classified information has been found in the 15 boxes of White House records that were stored at former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence. That is according to the National Archives and Records Administration. The agency said Friday that the matter has been referred to the Justice Department. They revealed the information in response to a February 9th letter to the House Committee on Oversight and Reform. Al BD is in the WML Traffic Center this morning.
On the Virginia side of the Beltway in McLean, there is a crash. Two left lanes are blocked on the inner loop near George Washington Parkway, exit 43. On 66 in Fairfax County, no reports of any slowdowns east or west. 95 in Virginia, it's clear between the Beltway and Fredericksburg. On the Maryland side of the Beltway, no reports of any slowdowns on the inner loop or on the outer loop. And 270 in Montgomery County is at speed between the Beltway and Frederick. And now for GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy start to the weekend. We will see some gusty winds as a cold front shifts through midday. Highs today into the upper 40s. The cold front will shift through anywhere between 11 o'clock this morning west of town, 1 to 2 o'clock to the south and east. Behind that front, we'll have some very gusty winds through the afternoon. A wind advisory is in effect through 7 o'clock. Could see gusts upwards of 50 miles per hour. Now, winds will diminish tonight. Clear skies. It will be cold. Lows in the teens to 20s across the region. For your Sunday, mostly sunny highs in the low to mid 40s. Warm up on President's Day Monday. High temperatures near 60 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett, the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
It's 26 degrees in the nation's capital at 6:32. Well, it's another holiday weekend here on the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jennifer Harper is with us. She writes Inside the Beltway, the Washington Times, of course. And it's nice to have you with us. As how many holidays are there in January and February now?
I forget. Good morning.
Let's talk about what could happen in 2024. We'll take a hike way down the highway here. And that all has to do with the former president, Donald Trump, and how Americans feel about the potential for him to run again. And this is, what, a CBS poll?
Yes, it is. And the big question is 45 going to try again in 24? That's my uncle's phrase. But anyway, yes, indeed, this is a CBS News poll, and it's got some interesting findings in it. And, we can go to the beginning and get the big numbers. CBS found that about two-thirds of Americans, U.S. adults, 65%, would prefer that Mr. Trump not launch another White House campaign. But it's interesting to note that 35% of the respondents said, yeah, we'd like to see him run again. That's like over a third of the respondents here, so it's not insignificant. And, certainly if you look at the even deeper numbers, it finds that 71% of those who voted for Mr. Trump in 2020 and even 10% of those who voted for Joe Biden would like to see him run again. And perhaps the most interesting part of this poll was they asked people, what motivates you to want to support him again? And this is what they said. 62% said he is the best candidate the Republicans have. 54% think he could win. He would win. And 51% simply said, I just support him. And about half, 48%, said he deserves another chance. And last but certainly not least, 25% said his entry into the race would be entertaining. And, of course, I kind of agree with that, too. But anyway, this poll was conducted with multiple answers. So that's what people are thinking.
Did they ask the question whether the folks wanted Joe Biden to run again in 2024?
That's another poll, I'm sure.
Okay. You know, we see people from a number of various fields kind of change it up and head into politics. We've seen Dr. Oz making the run in Pennsylvania for Senate. But somebody from kind of a field we don't expect, a little bit out of left field here.
Well, I don't know which field it comes from, but it certainly does come from a field. And certainly if you saw the Super Bowl, you saw also Michelle Tafoya. She is a longtime NBC sports broadcaster right there on the sidelines. Very good at it, too. A lot of people really like her. And she has offered commentary for 327 NFL games. Well, guess what? The political world is calling her, and she has informed The Athletic. Now, that's an industry publication, that she is now going to take on the role of a co-chair of a political campaign for businessman and Army veteran Kendall Qualls. And he announced in January he's running as Republican candidate for governor of Minnesota. And looks like Michelle kind of had a change of heart. She said, "I got to a point in my life where I wanted to try other things, and there are some things that are really important to me." And kind of looks like that's where she's going. And already she has appeared on Fox News, and she also appeared with former Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly. You remember her. She has a podcast, but she was on that this week. And certainly Michelle Tafoya, the new Republican candidate for governor handler, is worth watching.
One of the biggest issues of the past couple of years has been over masks. And where are we now when it comes to people masking or not?
Oh, that's a good way to put it, to mask or not to mask. Certainly, it's a very complicated question, and there was an Economist YouGov poll that asked people, well, are you wearing your mask now? And personally, I like going to an establishment, and if everybody's wearing a mask, well, I'll put mine on as a matter of etiquette. I don't know. I don't have the answer there for it all. But here's what the poll found. 38% of U.S. adults say they always wear a face mask outside of their home. And there's a big partisan divide here. Predictably, 22% of Republicans agree with that compared to 58% of Democrats. So essentially, there's a 40 percentage point difference there. And 22% overall say they wear a face mask most of the time. That includes 20% of Republicans and 27% of Democrats. And also 19% overall say they never wear a face mask. And that includes 29% of Republicans and only 4% of Democrats. And also 37% of Trump voters, folks who voted for Mr. Trump, say they never wear a face mask compared to only 4% of those who voted for Joe Biden. So partisan differences even in the mask world, Rick.
So it's bad enough to hear the news during the week and wonder where the world's going. But I went to the grocery store and the gas station in the same day, so I got hit with inflation. And then I'm like, well, where does the buck stop? I guess it stops at the White House, but I'm not the only one that's feeling kind of funky about things.
Yes, there is a name for it, and I was particularly amused this week by this. And this is the Biden Misery Index.
Ooh.
Has now appeared on Political Radar, and it is coming, this little handy phrase, the Biden Misery Index, was cited by Aaron Kligman. He is an analyst for Just the News. And he points out that the actual term misery index is not a new idea. This is very interesting. It was actually a phrase that was coined in the mid-1960s by an economist named Arthur Okun, who was an advisor to President Lyndon Johnson. So what they decided was to compare the levels of unemployment and inflation both and come up with an index for that. So I don't do math very well, so that's what it is. But anyway, it's been applied to several presidential tenures in past decades, and now it's President Biden's turn. And the index hit 11.5% in January, and this is the highest in a decade, according to Mr. Kligman over there at Just the News. And he said that the index is going upwards because Americans are now pessimistic about both the current state of the nation as well as its future. And he says there is reason for Democrats to worry. Public concern over crime, inflation, and other issues could spell trouble for Democrats in November. That's according to Mr. Gleepin over there at Just the News.
So you've got something you were talking about in the column that's coming up that might keep the president up past his bedtime?
Yes, I love the idea of that. But anyway, in case anybody is wondering out there, the White House Correspondents' Dinner is going to take place on April 30th. It's been gone for 2 years thanks to the pandemic. I'm not sure everybody missed it or not. But anyway, April 30th is a big day, and it's going to be a normal in-person event. It's going to be at the beautiful Washington Hilton. That's been the event's traditional home for many years. And according to an update from the National Press Club, this is the way they put it, fast-changing COVID-19 recommendations from the CDC and restrictions placed on indoor events by the District of Columbia add an extra layer of scheduling complexity to an event notable for its size and the presence of so many government officials and celebrities, and they are going to work this all out. And good for them. You know, it's complicated. Don't want to get into it this early in the morning. But there you go, April 30th, and they have hired Trevor Noah. He is the host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central to entertain at the big annual dinner, and we also add that this dinner raises money for college scholarships. So there you go.
Be interesting to see if the Cuomo boys show up at that one. Well, we hear new words being introduced, and then we hear words that we're not allowed to say anymore. What have you got in terms of the latest update on the dictionary?
Well, you know, Rick, there's always a lot of chat about all these new words that we're coming into contact with, and, you know, all from the woke idea of being socially aware and so forth and so on. And if you're wondering, those are called neo-pronouns when we have all these his and hers and everything else that you're supposed to identify with, but this is coming from a very great website called the College Fix, and they kind of monitor weird stuff that goes on in colleges. And they have discovered over in Britain that the University of Bristol has given a whole guidance for its staff on using pronouns at work, and that's all the typical ones, he and him and she and her and they and them, you know, whatever your preference is, there you go. But they have also decided they're going to introduce something called cat gender. Yes, you heard me right. This is when someone identifies as a feline. And this is called, according to the British Telegraph, by the way, I didn't make this up. But anyway, over at the University of Bristol, the lecturers are directed to neon pronouns, which include emoji pronouns, with someone identifies as an emoji, I guess, and also if they identify with a cat. So if you identify with cat gender, you can be called a nya or a nyan. That's a pronoun. It's spelled N-Y-A and N-Y-A-N. If you're curious, this is the Japanese word for meow. That's what they're doing at the University of Bristol, and, you know, we'll see if they come up with one for dogs. Why not? Or parakeets? Fine. Anyway, that's your educational update for the week.
Did you say neo up front?
The term for these new names are neo-pronouns.
Neo-pronouns from, I guess now, neo-knuckleheads, right? All right, well, let's leave it on a high note where, you know, there's some foundation, something solid here, some credibility for a change.
That sounds like a good idea. And I've got one for you, Rick, and all of our listeners. But that wisdom and the spirit and the inner mettle of Ronald Reagan is now going to be available to high school students. And this is something I got this week from the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. And here's what they say in response to the learning challenges faced by students and parents across the nation since the onset of the pandemic, the foundation, the institute, have launched the Reagan Academy. This is an e-learning program. It's going to focus on educating the future generation of America in the spirit of President Reagan's strongest attributes, leadership, communication, and informed decision-making. How about that? When was the last time you heard that? If you're curious, pre-enrollment is already underway. You got a child, a grandchild, a cousin, whatever. You can find all the details at ReaganFoundation.org and check under education. It's all right there, pretty straightforward.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, as always. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Have a good weekend, everybody.
And you too. 6:45, Saturday morning update. Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
On the Virginia side of the Beltway, heads up at McLean, there is a crash. Left lane is blocked on the inner loop near George Washington Parkway. No reports of any slowdowns or crashes on the outer loop of the Beltway in Virginia. 66 in Virginia is clear. 95 in Virginia between the Beltway and Fredericksburg, no delays. And on the Maryland side of the Beltway, from Prince George's County through Montgomery County, there are no delays being reported on the inner loop or on the outer loop. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Partly cloudy start to the weekend. We will see some gusty winds as a cold front shifts through midday. Highs today into the upper 40s. The cold front will shift through anywhere between 11 o'clock this morning west of town, 1 to 2 o'clock to the south and east. Behind that front, we'll have some very gusty winds through the afternoon. A wind advisory is in effect through 7 o'clock. Could see gusts upwards of 50 miles per hour. Now, winds will diminish tonight. Clear skies. It will be cold. Lows in the teens to 20s across the region. For your Sunday, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 40s. Warm up on President's Day Monday. High temperatures near 60 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Ligon at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
26 degrees, 6:46, the Saturday morning update. This is the Saturday morning update on News Talk 105.9 WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty joins us every Saturday morning. He is the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice, now in private practice at IFRA Law here in Washington. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
We're familiar with the shooting on the set of the film Rust by Alec Baldwin. Helena Hutchins died in October after she was allegedly shot by a prop gun that Baldwin, who is also a producer as well as actor on the film, was holding during rehearsals on the set. And Jim, you've studied that lawsuit that was filed this week. What did we not know that has come out in this filing?
A lot. I mean, there were a lot of things that I think were rumored, but it wasn't very clear if this was going to really play out the way some of those rumors had it. It's a devastating read for Alec Baldwin. It's a 29-page civil complaint suing for wrongful death. And wrongful death, Rick, is basically a negligence-based tort in this situation. And ultimately what it turns on is the knowledge that you're engaging in some sort of act or omission to act that is dangerous and that you have a duty to prevent harm from engaging in negligence. And so in this particular case, the idea of notice or knowledge for Alec Baldwin is a big part of that 29 pages. In fact, there's really, I think, three completely striking pieces of evidence in that complaint that relate to what Alec Baldwin would have known before the shooting. The first is they're using live ammunition. I mean, you simply don't use live ammunition on movie sets anymore. Generally, they're using either computer graphics or they're using guns that at most will shoot a BB, and that's basically to make it look like a real gun, but know that nobody could ever get harmed. Well, in this case, they were using live ammo. Number two, there were two live round accidents before the day of the shooting. And number three, on the day of the shooting, the local camera crew that had been working on this project, all of whom complaining that it was kind of a high-speed, money-oriented project without safety, they went to the production team and they said, the way you're doing this production is entirely unsafe. Someone's going to get hurt. And so the notice to Alec Baldwin as a producer and as an actor in this is incredibly powerful in terms of the way this complaint alleges it. And we also have, I think, the first public description of the actual shooting. And what the complaint alleges is that Baldwin was sitting on some stairs and he crossed through the gun. In other words, he reached across his body from right to left, pulled out the gun. When he pulled out the gun, the hammer was cocked, and when he released the hammer, the bullet was fired. It killed Miss Hutchins. The bullet actually traversed her body in a number of ways and finally came out and slammed into the man behind her and injured him. And then there's a detail in the complaint that, again, is incredibly ugly if true, which is that Baldwin did not attempt to render any aid. And so we saw that footage of him looking distraught on his phone along the roadside soon after the shooting had occurred. But this complaint has it where, you know, whatever he's doing, it wasn't helping the people he had just shot.
What kind of liability is he facing here? Obviously, financial liability if they find in favor of the family. What about criminal?
Yeah, I think if this complaint is 50% true, that he's probably looking at a manslaughter indictment in the near future. It would be involuntary manslaughter. That's a serious form of homicide, obviously not as serious as an intentional murder. But, you know, again, the only difference between a civil tort and a manslaughter in this case is whether you've got proof beyond a reasonable doubt that it was reckless or grossly negligent. This complaint, if you believe in it, is way over that line. And I think it's interesting to see what's going on in Santa Fe, where this is being investigated, because, you know, obviously bringing the movie industry to Santa Fe is probably something that, you know, that the local politicians are all in favor of. So I don't know if there's any sort of political reluctance, but if these facts are true, you know, I think most honest prosecutors are going to be indicting at some point.
So in essence, he could be facing two separate trials.
Absolutely. Yeah, usually what happens if there's an overlap, if there's a criminal case and a civil case, the criminal prosecutors don't want to have their case mucked up by the civil litigation. So frequently they will seek a stay, meaning a suspension of that civil case. So the timing is everything, though. You know, if the civil case keeps chugging along and they go to the discovery phase and the motions and the trial, it's conceivable that it could get wrapped up before the criminal case. But I think, if anything, this puts a little pressure on the criminal case or the investigation to hurry up and wrap up.
We saw the very emotional trial of Kim Potter, the former Brooklyn Center, Minnesota police officer. She was convicted, of course, of killing Daunte Wright. Well, the sentencing took place on Friday. The judge appeared to get choked up in her remarks after she delivered the sentence. She was very respectful of the challenges that law enforcement faces every day. And Kim Potter made a very tearful apology to the family. Tell us about the sentence and your thoughts on how the court treated her.
Well, you know, sentencing in a case like this is not surprising when it comes to emotionality. It was, I think, a very challenging day for Judge Chu. And from what I saw of it, she conducted herself very professionally. Yes, she got caught up in the emotion of it as well, recognized the gravity of the harm and kind of the tragedy on both sides of the aisle. But she was very judicious, and she went through the sentencing guidelines, which is where judges typically start, you know, an advisory range that they're supposed to try to land in unless there's something different about this case. And the guidelines in this case were 6.5 to 8 years for a first-degree manslaughter conviction. And I think the judge correctly departed from the guidelines. She said, you know, the underlying facts of this particular manslaughter case are just so different than what you would typically see in a manslaughter scenario. I mean, you could have police brutality. You could have barroom brawls that escalate into somebody shooting a gun. But none of them really approach the kind of tragic negligence of the case with Officer Potter. So she sentenced Officer Potter to 2 years. She'll serve about 16 months of that. I think she probably has about 2 of those months already done. And then she'll be on supervised release.
Well, that's the sentencing, but let's look at the conviction and the case overall. You know, it's a very difficult case.
I struggle a lot with this case. I still have a real hard time respecting the speed at which charging decisions were made. Remember, Officer Potter had the incredible misfortune to have engaged in this moment during the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis. And so there was a real speed rush to get her indicted very quickly, and sure enough, it was a very quick decision for something that I think was complicated and difficult to sort through. And I recognize the jury instructions in this area where you're talking about manslaughter and defense of others and the concept of misdemeanor manslaughter, which is kind of like, even if you only committed a misdemeanor, if somebody died, you're now a manslaughter person. I mean, all of those are tricky concepts, and so I don't know that I begrudge the jury with the state of the law and the way the instructions were read to them. But ultimately, I look at this police officer, somebody who may not have been the best cop. She may not have been you know, up for the job when it got to that kind of danger and difficulty. But I think her trial testimony was genuine. I think her instant sorrow was legitimate. And I think it was a horrible mistake, but I really struggle to call it a criminal one. So if you reluctantly respect the verdict, which is, I guess, about where I am, then I think you can also respect Judge Chu's very thoughtful decision. I mean, this was not a police brutality case. It was not a case based on race. No matter how much Ben Crump, as a family attorney, tries to fan racial flames, I just don't think there was any aspect of this case that you can say was actually driven by race. So to latch onto it as, you know, the failed criminal justice system narrative, I think is just irresponsible and not accurate. And I understand the emotions of the moment for people that love Dante Wright, but I think if you step back and look at this case objectively, it was a tragedy on every level, a difficult case to view as criminal culpability, but a pretty fair sentence meted out to reflect that by Judge Chu yesterday.
A lot of back and forth this week in the firestorm over a filing, I guess, from special counsel John Durham. Fox News took it one way, and Hillary Clinton took it the complete opposite. Big deal on Fox. Hillary Clinton says it's nonsense. The filing in the case against Michael Sussman, a lawyer for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign, he's been charged with lying to a top FBI official. But, Jim, what happened in this filing that created all of the headlines this week?
Yeah, I mean, the real short version of it is it was a routine filing with a little bit of language that set the world on fire. And ultimately, we're going to be left with more questions and answers at this juncture. But the filing was essentially, again, a very routine thing, asking the court to make sure there's not a conflict of interest for some of the attorneys that are involved. And I know from experience that if you're really aggressively seeing what you think is an ethical violation as a prosecutor, you don't file a motion for an inquiry. You file a motion to disqualify. In other words, you say, I believe that they are conflicted. They need to be off this case. This is just kind of housekeeping, keeping a clean record. So the motion itself is not the focal point at all. But in the motion, they allege certain facts, background facts. And again, that's not unusual because you want to explain a little bit to the court where the conflict comes from. But in describing some of the conduct of Michael Sussman, the attorney indicted for a false statement to the FBI, they mention this data mining operation. And Executive Tech One, who's been publicly identified as Mr. Rodney Joffe, he apparently gained some sort of access to White House servers as well as to the addresses belonging to Donald Trump. And what's interesting is, you know, immediately you had the emotional reaction from everyone. Donald Trump and his supporters said this is a smoking gun proof of Hillary Rodham Clinton spying. Hillary just said it's a crazy conspiracy theory and, you know, don't look at the evidence, just believe me. But the truth is it's really a lot of it's still unknown, and this is very tricky technologically. So this executive tech that was engaged in data mining was engaged in something called domain name analysis, and it's really sifting through almost like radio transmissions from computers, massive amounts of data, and it looks for connections between computers and servers. It does not, and this is where I think the overstatement from the right came in this situation, it does not give you the content of any communication or even the context. It's almost like the computers are operating like they had just GPS coordinates. The data you're looking at has to be starting with finding the exact coordinate. You know, where are the coordinates associated with the Trump Tower, for instance, and where are the ones associated with maybe the Alpha Bank or something Russian? If you have that information, you can sift through the thousands of kind of mindless transmissions that are going on between computers and try to find some sort of link that connects GPS coordinate one to GPS coordinate two. That can be very innocent. It can be, you know, my web page refreshes the WMAL four times during the morning. That's going to leave a trail of data for these people to analyze. If I do a Google search for Alpha Bank, that will too. Or if I start to put in an email address, it has some connection. There's a lot of ways to kind of link you to something like, you know, Russia or Alpha Bank that don't really mean there's any connection or even any communication. So it's tricky, but the questions that rise from it are what in the world is this sensitive arrangement that the data miners had with the Obama White House, which is really kind of interesting stuff. And also, keep in mind, they never did, even with all this high-tech stuff, this intrusive thing. They didn't dredge up any real connections between Trump and Russia. You know, the context of the paragraph in this motion is to say Sussman was wrong to act as if he had a smoking gun when he went to the FBI. So, you know, by itself, again, more questions than answers. Later in the week, the defense filed a scathing motion saying that magic paragraph, paragraph 5 in particular, is inaccurate and gratuitous, and asked the court to strike the factual background part of the special counsel's pleading. So this is actually going to be the first test of a trial judge feeling about the Durham probe. You know, me personally, I haven't seen leaks or public posturing by John Durham, which I think is a healthy contrast to what we saw with the leaks coming out of the Mueller probe. But it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks here to see how this motion is resolved and to see if the judge has any ire towards John Durham.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. You can follow him on Twitter. Trusty Lawyer Jim, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Heather Curtis has the news next. Then we're back with John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkinson, Tony Schaefer, and KT McFarland.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.